The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
This is The Money Show. It's brought to you by APSA Access, an award-winning, secure, single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's African Asset. APSA is a registered FSP. Standing by for Alan Pullinger this evening, the chief executive at First Rand, a much better than expected set of results out of First Rand today. But the tone of the market massively negative. And we saw a huge pullback today in financial stocks, huge pullback in resources shares as the underlying commodity prices continued to slide. Talk to David Mackay at miningmax.com this evening about Sibanye's great transformation initiative from a gold mining company into a platinum group metals business, and now looking to do a joint venture with an Australian company to produce, to mine battery minerals, the minerals that will go into energy storage devices of the future. That's going to change the future for the better. So we'll talk about that this evening. Also catch up with Athol Williams. Remember Athol Williams? He's chief executive of the Institute of Social and Corporate Ethics, but he used to work for Bain, and he turned into a whistleblower, went to the Zondo Commission. He's outraged at Bain and company back in the country, back to the party, and back inside at Business Leadership South Africa, saying that, hold on a second, Business Leadership South Africa said there was a process to get reintroduced. Has Bain really made amends for its role in state capture and its assistance in the dismantling of SARS? That is the big question, of course. And so we'll talk about that with some detail tonight. Nick Haralambos is going to give us lessons from side hustles. Remember, now he's upped the game through a generous donation to one from 1,000 to 5,000 Rand a day when he gives away money to people wanting to start their own micro enterprises. And he's coming across some really interesting ideas and some really fabulous people that all they need is a bit of guidance and a bit of cash, and then they need to be unleashed. And some of these side hustles may turn into some decent businesses one day. And Kim Borchiter is in for us this evening. She is a certified financial planner. She's at Chartered Wealth Solutions, talking about whether or not you should ever gamble your pension on starting a business. I'll ask Pavlo Fatidis that question as well. I think you'll have a different view to Kim. But hey, that's what makes The Money Show interesting. We'll do that tonight on the show between now and 8 p.m.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, shares in banks fell very, very sharply today, including in the country's most valuable bank. It reported a 56% rise in profits. It said bad debts are improving. The outlook's okay. But all big banks have been enjoying a big rebound thanks to the fact that they've made huge provisions in their accounts for a much worse year than actually materialized over the last 12 to 18 months. Alan Pullinger is chief executive of the First Rand Group. He's on the line to us from Johannesburg this evening. And you're seeing a much stronger than expected performance coming through your business units, Alan, at least most of them.
Yeah, hi, Bruce, and good evening to the listeners. Yeah, I mean, we're pleased with where we've got to. I mean, you know, we made the point that I guess the strength and speed of the rebound did surprise us. It is all around credit, you know, so we had to raise all these huge provisions at the start of the, you know, go the pandemic, and we had a huge book of relief and giving customers payment holidays, and of course, you're never sure how that's all going to sort of work out, and I guess Things have worked out better for us from a credit perspective, better collections, and then at the same time, the economy has improved as well. So I think when you add those two things together, it means that you've got a much, much lower charge for credit. That drives your earnings, and that's really the reason for the rebound. So we're pleased where we've got to. Returns are back, dividends are back, and hopefully from here, we can sort of see some steady growth going forward.
I mean, how apprehensive are you in, I don't know if that's a forecast or a wish or a desire or a plan, but how apprehensive are you considering just how vulnerable we were exposed to be courtesy of the riots that we saw in July?
Yeah, you know, Bruce, we were affected by it. I mean, more than 30 of our branches, I think, were vandalized, and 250 ATMs or slightly more were properly damaged, but you know, I think we almost learned from the pandemic. You know, the business didn't get into a victim sort of mind state. We really kind of went into this fix. How do we solve We've got customers that need cash. We've got, you know, SASA payouts happening, you know, in a week's time. You know, how do we activate? And to be honest, I mean, we pushed the button on plans. And so we had to roll out a whole lot of mobile ATMs, mobile branches. We spoke to a lot of our retail clients that we bank on the wholesale side. I mean, we made a plan around sort of cash out at till. You know, we really sort of collaborated around this thing. So we still got a long way to go. You know, some of our branches still haven't opened, and some of the ATMs I think are going to take us some time to replace all that infrastructure. A lot of it is imported. But, you know, I think, Bruce, you know, there's some silver linings to this thing. You know, one, I think the fact that it didn't scale through the country, I think, is massively positive. I mean, this thing really had the potential to get out of hand. Yeah. Of course, it caused a lot of damage, and you can just see that in the Sasria claims. But I do think that the country ultimately triumphed here. And yeah, listen, business models will change, and I'm sure you'll see different sort of processes. But, you know, we move on. It's an attractive, this is still in a very attractive country. You know, we still make good returns, good customer propositions, lots of, you know, competition. And so, and things are looking up, I think, on the economy side.
Well, now, explain that to me, because I think very few people actually feel that. Very few people are experiencing it. We've got 1.5 million more people unemployed than were 18 months ago. And a lot of people are taking a huge amount of strain. When you talk about improvements in the economy, I get it. I'm curious as to what you see, though, in terms of a turnaround.
Yeah, Bruce, so, I mean, are people taking strain? Of course. And you know, when we talk about this relief book that we had, where we gave customers payment holidays and deferrals and that, I mean, across the group, that is still 167 billion for us. So that's still an enormous book that is out there, and we need to help customers get through that and collect the book and hopefully have a good outcome. But it tells you, to your point, the degree of strain that's out there. But I think there's some early data points which are telling us that the economy is starting to turn. You know, one of the things we've spoken about before was this build-up of precautionary savings. And people also borrowed less. So you saw a lot of the banks' lending books contract, and you saw a big accumulation of deposits. Now, that's understandable in you know, something like a pandemic. But what we are starting to see now are those savings balances starting to be drawn down, and an appetite for credit. So those credit is picking up, and the rate of growth in savings is starting to slow. And we're starting to see the emergence of what we would say is a consumer-led, you know, I think vaccine-enabled pickup in activity. And I think it's the formation of what we would call a credit cycle, the early stages of a credit cycle. And so you'll see better lending. And it also sort of falls in line with what's happening with interest rates. So typically when you see interest rates slowly starting to lift, you know, and you're getting into that normalization. Inflation is very well anchored. I mean, in fact, so much so that we think we can tighten the you know, that inflation target, the band, and I think that'll be a great outcome. Mm-hmm. But I think these things will, you know, are likely to lift from here. And then I guess once corporates see that sustained demand coming through, then they start investing in capacity. At the moment, corporates have got a lot of capacity, idle capacity. So I think it's less about they haven't got the confidence to invest. There's actually no reason for them to invest because they're sitting with capacity. So we need that capacity to be taken up. And then I think corporates will jump in, and then you'll see, you know, the wholesale market starting to follow. So I think they are... There's certainly some green shoots out there, and the structural reform, we've spoken about that a lot, Bruce. It does look like it's slowly getting traction. Yes, it's painful and it is frustrating, and we could go much faster. And often, you know, we take a step forward and then half a step back. But I think slowly but surely we're edging forward.
I would agree with you on that. I'm wondering whether or not there are things within the business of FirstRand that have changed fundamentally in the last 18 months. A couple of things that you no longer do, things that you've changed doing, and you see that change as being permanent. I'm just wondering on a high level whether or not you can tell us some of those things.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce, I mean, I suppose the most obvious is this, you know, this work from home or sort of remote working. I think we were always headed in that direction to a degree. You know, pre the pandemic, these tools that enable this were out there, you know, Zoom and Microsoft Teams and all these good things. I mean, they were available and we probably hadn't fully embraced them, but we had a plan to embrace them. I think what we would have done is we would have dipped our toes into the water around this remote working, and we would probably have tried it in some areas of the bank. We would have said to people, why don't you spend a day away from the office, work from home, see how it goes. We would monitor, check our processes, you know, what are we losing, what are we gaining, how do we tweak the system, and then we probably would have expanded it to maybe 2 days and try. Unfortunately, what we had here with the pandemic, I mean, literally we went from, you know, fully at the office with 3 days' notice, 95% of our employees are going home. And there was no time to check anything, you know, no processes. We just simply needed to make it happen. And so I think really where we are now is we're probably in the process of trying to walk that back a bit to say, listen, where is that happy middle ground? I don't think it is where it is now. I think we're being more confident now with kind of vaccines, and I think we can get there. But it is important that we sort of try to find a good rhythm. And I'm not sure that has been solved as yet. I guess some things are permanent. You know, a consequence of that, I suppose, is we're going to need less physical infrastructure. So, you know, office space, I'm sure we can do with less. And there's probably some buildings that we're going to have to, you know, shed or let out in time and, you know, eventually dispose of. So I think that's going to happen. I suppose, you know, there's been a big learning here for us, you know, around this pandemic. You know, things that were always there, and, you know, these scientists said to us, well, a pandemic could happen, and we always used to think these were these futurists that were always worried about these things. Well, guess what? I mean, it happened. And I suppose the next big thing for us is now climate. So, yes, you've got the fossil fuel and the coal debate, but I think we're quickly going to get we're going to be over that, and we're going to be talking about water.
No, well, I mean, there's so many crises just waiting to happen. And I mean, today you've also announced you are following, I think it's Nedbank, in no longer funding coal projects. And I think, you know, it's going to become the norm rather than the exception. What has driven this final decision? And I wonder whether or not it assists the energy transition that we're almost forcing a change in behavior and a change in resource access.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce, I mean, I think you're right, and I mean, I'd love to come on the line and tell you, listen, you know, we went and had a sort of a aha moment, and we realised the next big thing is climate, and we always had planned to do this. There's no doubt that I think the narrative out there, I think we've, you know, we've been nudged. Let me use that word, but I mean, we've been nudged. You know, I think generally in a friendly way. But activists, shareholders, stakeholders, you know, foreign lenders, I mean, everyone has said to us, guys, you know, you need to relook at this topic. And I think the board always had climate, you know, on their long list of risks that they consider. But this thing has moved up the ranking, no doubt. So this is kind of probably top four now for the board. So it's taking a lot more time at the board. And I guess once it gets to that level, well, then you start getting resources and you get policies and board says, listen, we'd like to see some action here. The stuff we put out, Bruce, is, you know, we talk about it being really authentic and anchored. We didn't just sort of, you know, quickly write those policies over a weekend. Mm. We've done a lot of stakeholder engagement. We've spoken to government. We've spoken to NBI, which is kind of the arm of BUSA that's been working on this topic. We spent a lot of time with Eskom, with Sasol. They have very, very impressive people and plans around this transition. And so what we've done is align sort of our plans sort of contextually in the journey that South Africa's got to make. And you know that, you know, we're soon heading off as a country to COP26, where the climate debate is up and fossil fuels and coal in particular is sort of front and center. I mean, they, you know, to put it in sort of their words, they want to sort of consign coal to the history books. I mean, they really focused on this. And as a country, listen, we one of the handful of countries that really is in the spotlight. I think it's a massive opportunity for us because there's a lot of money internationally that is looking to help those countries that are prepared to make the transition. And so for us, I think we should see it in that light. Huge opportunity. Of course, we're going to need to do it carefully. There's lots of communities and that we need to bring along for that journey. But the upside is also huge. That's where we are.
It's a fascinating insights. Thank you, Alan Pullinger, this evening, the chief executive at First Rand Energy Transitions. And you've got so many people who work in coal mines, so many industries that are still heavily dependent on coal. But somehow you have to force a transition. And that sort of breakthrough of foreign money willing to come and sort of allow us to more quickly transition, I think may be helpful. Fascinating insights this evening from Alan Pullinger, chief executive at First Rand.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
And on to Rudy van der Merwe. Rudy is a portfolio manager at AdviceWorks. And what a dreadful day on our market. Can you explain it, please, Rudy? Because, more than 1,000 points down, smashed across the financial sector, smashed across the resources shares.
Evening, Bruce. Yeah, absolutely. There's really nowhere to hide today. Commodities really took it in the teeth, and the sector was down over 4%. Commodity prices of late have been under quite a lot of pressure, so I think that that's certainly a big contributor towards this, partly as a result of some slowing of the Chinese economy, but also their intention to try and manage commodity prices down to some extent. And then we also got hit quite badly as part of this commodity process that we're seeing. Now, our terms of trade are changing quite substantially. So last year, we were in a very good position in the sense that our export commodities, being iron ore and coal and the like, and the PGM sector, all were at record prices. And our biggest import, being oil, was at absolute sort of record low levels. And that meant we had big current account surpluses, and the rand strengthened as a result. But slowly, we've seen those flows starting to change. You know, oil prices have recovered very substantially, so our imports are now a lot higher than they were, and the export commodity prices have been coming under pressure. So the actual flows through our economy mean that the rand now starts coming under pressure as well, and as a result of the rand getting weaker, we will get probably increased pressure on interest rates in due course, and I think that brought our financial sector under quite a lot of pressure. So everything interest rate sensitive, like the banks and the retailers, for example, were under pressure today with the rand soft.
Absolutely everything intertwined, of course, and coming through very strongly on the day. What did you make of those First Rand results? They looked considerably better than anyone might have anticipated. Not that that was reflected in the share price, which had already rallied very strongly up until this point, but they were good numbers.
They absolutely were good numbers, Bruce. Obviously coming off a low base, but all the same, they've managed their costs very effectively. I think cost increases were around sort of 3%. The return on equity is back to sort of 18-odd%, which is within their target range of 18 to 22. They've benefited significantly, obviously, as a result of the credit costs coming down, but they've been conservative in terms of lending, so their advances have declined by 3%. And I think that's partly conservatism and possibly also partly just a lack of demand for credit. And that's something we need to see change. Banks need to grow their lending books to keep healthy balance sheets. But their deposits increased, and that enabled them to structure their funding quite smartly over the last year. So they, within banks, there's a group of people called ALCO specialists or asset liability specialists. So they determine also largely at what term the bank gets its funding and from who it gets its funding. And a lot of that influences the cost of that funding. And First Rand have been really smart at that. And quite honestly, that's the most important thing a bank does is manage its balance sheet. And most of the rest of what it does is noise. And they've been very clever about that. So they haven't been really hurt by the dropping interest rates over the last couple of years, and that's stand out. So I think they're very well positioned going forward, and probably the best positioned of all the banks, I suspect, just at the moment.
Well, certainly their rating is the highest. They're always highly rated. And the share price, you know, it fluctuates. It's been in quite a tight range of about 54 to 62 rand a share for quite some time. Interested to see if these results help it break out of that very tight range. Talk to me about AVI. It's trading under cautionary. Nobody else on the JSE published a cautionary. So it says, are they buying or are they selling? Or is there perhaps a foreign buying looking to do a pioneer on them, I wonder?
Well, Bruce, all of those are possibilities. AVI is, you know, share price went up almost 4% today on the back of this cautionary, just saying that they're in negotiations, and that could mean almost anything. By the nature of the business, I would expect that it's rather somebody that they are looking at buying. I think a lot of the buyouts we've seen have been of companies that are, on the one hand, extremely cheap and that needed a lot of fixing. And that's not the case with AVI. It's not a broken business. It's not in ruins. I mean, they're in a reasonably tough spot in terms of margin pressure and the like, but there's nothing in it that's, you know, poorly structured. They don't have too much debt. Their businesses aren't in any sort of trouble. So it's an incredibly well-run, highly cash-generative business. And I suspect they have probably found something that they think is cheap and needs fixing. You know, they're the ones doing the corporate activity. And I think they'll be driving that bus rather than be the targets of somebody looking for a bargain.
I've seen some speculation that they tried to sell I&J a couple of years ago, that I&J could be back on the chopping block or whatever you do with fish.
That's a distinct possibility, Bruce. You know, I think these fishing businesses are somewhat unattractive. I mean, so it's the one part of their business that I don't really like, and for a couple of reasons. One of them, their earnings are incredibly volatile. You know, they're massively driven by the cost of fuel. So when fuel prices are low, they do fare very well, and when fuel prices go up, they struggle. So that's the one part of it, and I think their catch rates over the last number of years have been under tremendous pressure. I mean, we know that oceans generally are looking increasingly overfished, and so the consistency of their ability to generate persistent catch rates, which keeps them profitable, I think is over time just coming under more pressure. So I'd actually be thrilled if they did sell that business.
Rudy van der Merwe at AdviceWorks, thank you very much for your contribution this evening, Rudy. Rudy is a regular contributor on a Thursday night to The Money Show. I see today that the initial public offering, the IPO of a Swiss company that makes sneakers, it's backed by Roger Federer, seen a 50% increase on debut in New York, giving it an $11 billion valuation. Plenty of rivals, of course, looking to make a turn on sneakers. But we saw the Roger Federer take a stake in this company about 2 years ago. And since then, it's had a really, really good track record, and it's seen sales grow about 60% a year. And the pace has picked up, particularly in North America, in terms of its sales. And the company On is really, it's doubled its market in the first 6 months of this year. So On is flying, and it's interesting to see with the Roger Federer's backing to see how it's going to take on and how it's going to fit into what is a massively competitive global sneaker market.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Access, an award-winning secure single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Nick Haralambos joins us in about 10 minutes' time. We'll talk to him about side hustles. Remember last week he managed to secure an extra big a bundle of cash. And so instead of giving away 1,000 rand for each interaction he has with somebody who he coaches to start a side hustle, he's now up that to 5,000 rand a time. It's a magnificent breakthrough. So yes, far considerably more empowering than previously and having that much bigger impact. So we'll hear from him about some side hustlers. Well, I'm curious about the diversification happening or not happening in the mining sector. Gold miners are gold miners. Platinum group metals miners are platinum group metals miners, iron ore, you know, you understand, they've got some offshoots, of course, but we're not seeing that much aggressive alternatives coming through. We are seeing lots of pressure at the moment on platinum group metals. Companies that have been making a killing in the boom times risk now seeing it slow down dramatically or even come to an end. One company, though, appears to be diversifying far more than any other in the industry. And Sibanye, which started out as a gold mining company operating the old Goldfield South Africa mines, diversified into platinum group metals, made a big acquisition in the United States called Stillwater, and now it plans to spend more than 7 billion rand on a joint venture with an Australian mining firm called Ionia to mine metals used in batteries. And David Mackay is the editor at miningmax.com. Is Sibanye the most versatile and diverse and possibly nimble mining company in the country, David?
Yeah, definitely the latter, I would say. Nimble, very entrepreneurial. But I think they've kind of recognized, you mentioned they started off with the gold in South Africa, very deep level, very expensive, very risk-laden from a safety perspective in particular, and then have moved into platinum and then have looked at how the platinum market's moving, and they've kind of thought to themselves, hang on a sec, there's a bit more to this platinum demand than just jewelry and investment, and that's the industrial side. And a lot of platinum goes into mobility, into cars. Now, with the advent of, you know, the electric vehicle industry, that's opened a whole new suite of metals, and that's what they're getting into.
And it goes beyond electric vehicles as well. I mean, with the world moving to more renewable sources of energy, battery storage is a theme for the next, I don't know, until we come up with a better idea. And those sort of huge batteries, of course, are absolutely pivotal for the future too.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the whole increase in demand for batteries is, it's quite different. If you remember the last major mining boom, decade, I don't know, 2002 to 2008, somewhere around there, the so-called super cycle, was very kind of GDP-driven, and specifically China. So the industrialization of China sort of precipitated a massive demand for minerals, and the super cycle was predicated upon that. This is way different. This has a kind of multi-generational feel. It's also politically sanctioned across all major economies. It's a massive move towards decarbonization. Consumers want it, and governments have to listen to their consumers. They have to listen to their constituency, and hence the politically sanctioned aspect of this market demand. I don't know if that's going to be a short-lived thing. I suspect not. But whilst I wouldn't say the days of the internal combustion engine are over, I think we're going to see massive uptake in a variety of batteries going into electric cars. I say variety because science is outdoing itself. So you get batteries that use lithium, and you get others that have manganese. And then you have the hydrogen economy, which is fuel cell technology. Won't get into details. Suffice to say that it brings PGMs or platinum group metals back into the picture. So it's a pretty fascinating place to be at the moment, mining. But then, Bruce, I would say that.
No, you would. I mean, I recall my first ever discussion with you an awfully long time ago, and you said, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, why is a guy dedicating his life writing about a sunset industry? And the mining industry has just grown and grown and grown since then. Where it's not growing is in gold. And I think what is happening in Sibanye's case, and Neil Froneman, the chief executive, has made it clear, saying unless there's some kind of miracle in the gold price, they won't be mining gold in South Africa by 2030.
Yeah, it's the one part of Sibanye that still needs to be ticked, as it were, the one part of the strategy you want to say what's happening. And valuation, the fact that they exposed the gold, as I mentioned earlier, has a big impact on valuation. And I think Sibanye kind of recognize that it's holding them back. Hence, you know, there was a lot of talk, I'm not sure if you followed it, but towards the end of last year, beginning of this year, a lot of talk about Sibanye maybe doing a two-way deal with Goldfields and Anglo Gold, creating a South African champion to kind of breathe new life into the gold strategy. But the important part of that was that the gold they were buying in Anglo Gold and Goldfields wasn't in South Africa. They are Johannesburg-registered businesses or headquartered, but their gold operations are all over the world. And so I think they were seeking that kind of diversification, less politically risky, less safety, problematic, and with longer lives than they've got in South Africa. So a big question mark over that. But these battery metal deals are very interesting because it raises the question of, well, you're making all this money now, you promise us dividends, and you're just blowing it all on projects that may or may not be good ones. So that is an interesting question to ask about Sibanye as well.
No, absolutely. I mean, this deal with Ioneer, I mean, where do we find, we know that some of our cell phone components, the rare metals that are in those are only found in places like the DRC and other hard to access places, which is one of the reasons why they are rare and hard to access, makes them incredibly valuable. But what is Sibanye looking to do with this Australian company, something in which it can invest 7 billion rand?
Yeah, so in the case of Ioneer, I think they've taken in fact, with all of their recent battery metals investments and over 10 billion rands worth of investments since the beginning of the year, they've gone into joint ventures or taken a large but nonetheless minority stake in the business, non-operational as well, but have also bought shares in the parent business that owns those assets, giving themselves an option to take over at some point in time. So they've taken very much a portfolio kind of approach to their battery metal strategy. Same with Ioneer. So they've gone into a 50-50 joint venture and have taken 7.3%, I think the number is 7.6%, in Ioneer itself, just to give them that option.
And had it not globalized at the time that it did, had it not taken and done the Stillwater deal, which has paid off very, very handsomely courtesy of the boom that we have seen, however long-lived that might be, in Platinum Group Metals prices, would Sibanye be in a position to be doing this today?
I think they got lucky, to be honest. I think they recognized that they could do in the platinum sector what they were able to do in gold, and that's put adjacent mines that were separately owned together, extract synergies and try and derive some value in that way. In the case of PGMs, though, I mean, I do say they read the market, and I give them some credit for that, but I don't think they even vaguely understood, nor did anyone, just how massive the uptick in demand for PGMs would be. And I think that's really sort of given them a massive fillip in terms of their overall business direction, the cash that they're generating. I think not having done that PGM deal initially, they would never have had the platform that they've got now, and it's making a lot of money. So I kind of facetiously asked about the dividend. I think the investments that they've done in battery metals have been bite-sized, and they're not all demanding cash in the here and now. In the case of Ioneer, they only have to sort of pay that money in a year's time or so. But I think they've really gone about it in a sensible way, haven't imperiled the dividend, which is now back firmly in place. And it's looking like a very smart, nimble, as you said, entrepreneurial business, but not yet getting the full value for what they've invested in, but they would argue.
David Mackay, always wonderful to get your insights on South Africa's mining sector, editor at miningmax.com. And that conversation did happen. He probably doesn't remember it, but I was petrified. It was an interview situation. David was one of the people interviewing me. I wasn't thinking that. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. Don't tell him. In that interview. And he was saying, you're probably thinking this. No, I'm not. But yes, smile and nod. And hey, got the job. So that was good. David Mackay, the editor at miningmax.com.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Side Hustle Thursday. Nick Haralambos has written the book. He's now running the courses. He's raised the funding. He is giving away 5,000 Rand plus time, his time, valuable time, to help young people, anybody actually, we've had some older people, help anybody who wants to start a side hustle, who ticks the boxes that he needs to do. And somebody who's been ticking boxes has been ticking pizza boxes, Nick Haralambos, and that's Tsipiso. Tell me about Tsipiso's pizza hustle.
Great segue, Bruce. Tsipiso was such a fantastic call for me this week. She is out in Springs and 3 years ago started a side hustle selling pizzas, and now it is her full-time gig. And it's just so bubbling with ideas and interesting thoughts. And she's the only pizza maker in her township, which I love. And we discussed doubling down on that. So Tsipiso's getting the 2,500 Rand up front, plus my online course and 2,500 Rand in cash. And she's going to be using some of that money to test out some interesting ways to make money throughout the day, not just at nights with pizza. So she's going to be trying a dessert pizza, a breakfast pizza, and some crazy toppings like a chakalaka pizza, which I love. If you want to find her, you can go to her Instagram. It's M-W-A-R-I pizza.
M-W-A-R-I pizza. We will check that out on Instagram. And yeah, it's just wonderful. And I love the innovation and I love the gutsiness and also just appealing to local flavors, for goodness sake. I mean, it's really nice to see. What about Tami Majiki? Landscaping and garden maintenance. It's yet another one of those businesses where you can get a group of friends together, all with similar mindset. Everybody wants to work hard, and you can get people to graft and actually build something fairly substantial.
Yeah, definitely. And Tommy's story is just really great. It's a side hustle he's been running for about 4 years. He works with three or four younger people over the times that he does these jobs to help educate them on how to do the things that he does. And because it's a side hustle, they're trying to gain exposure and expand their customer base. So Tami and I discussed things like doing B2B rather than residential and talking, reaching out to corporates or office parks. So if you're a corporate, if you're an office park in the south of Johannesburg and you are looking for a landscaper or a garden maintenance person, please reach out to Tami. You can go to Facebook and search for Garden Stoners on Facebook. It's because they use a lot of stones in their garden solutions. And I have to say, we've already had a fantastic offer from Rolex. They are donating a new lawnmower to him, which is just incredible. I posted on LinkedIn, and within a few minutes, they had contacted me to support him.
Fantastic. Well done, Rolex. That's lovely to see. I just love the way people are coming in from all sides with all kinds of contributions to, you know, if you're in that industry, you can make a difference to one person's life. My goodness me, the starfish principle very much in action. And of course, the guys at Yoko are also giving away the Yoko card machines as well and continue to do so. Talk to me about the lessons that you're imparting to these people who wanted to start their business. And so often, one of the hardest things to do is get pricing absolutely right. You want to get business, so you price yourself below your competitors, and hey, you get lots of business, and then you lose money, and then you go bust because, hey, you weren't priced properly, or you really find yourself getting unstuck and being trapped, being stuck in a price trap. How do you get price right?
Yeah, this is something you and I have definitely discussed before, but it is worth bringing up again because Tami also raised this problem with me that, you know, he's had a couple of quotes, like three quotes in the last 6 months, not call him back because he thinks his price is too expensive. And my simple answer is really, you need to sell more. If you've only had three quotes out of seven rejected or not calling you back, then you probably should be calling 50. So oftentimes your pricing problem is a sales problem. You're just talking to the wrong people, or you haven't talked to enough people, you haven't sent enough proposals out. So that's the first thing, is don't rush to lower your price, because truthfully, it's probably that you haven't sold enough. And the second thing really is that there's often a mismatch between your service and pricing and the customer you think you're selling to. So if the customer is telling you that you're too expensive, or you think that that's the case, the chances are you aren't. You're just selling to the wrong person. So your gut check shouldn't be immediately to discount and to lower your price. It should be to go out and find a customer that wants to pay for your service. And we all have been there. The customers that negotiate and haggle the most and pay the least are the worst customers anyways. So avoid them like the plague and find the right customer for your pricing structure.
But when do you get to a point where you know that you're actually are just priced out of the market? It's actually, you know, it is about the price. People say, hey, I don't like you very much, but they don't return the calls. And the clue could possibly be in that pricing. And at some point, some people have to acknowledge that.
Definitely. I think so there's a combination of things. The first is do a market analysis and see what your competitors are charging. And how you do that is really easy. Phone them. Don't tell them who you are. Just ask them for a quote. It's okay to do that. There's nothing wrong with that. And then you have to have volume of sales. So like I said just now, if you've only sold to one person and they tell you you're too expensive, that is not a data point. That is an opinion. So sell to 50 people. If they all tell you, or majority tell you, then you might have a pricing problem. But the combination of market research and actual sales and talking to customers is when you're going to figure out if your price is too high.
Nick Haralambos, thank you very much for joining us as always on a Thursday evening. Nick is an author, he's an entrepreneur, and he is running slowhustle.org. If you're looking for some help, if you need some funding to start your business, he's now got more cash than he had in the beginning, courtesy of Nedbank. And of course, he's got Yoko on board and Rolex making that, donating a lawnmower, which is just fabulous for garden stoners, for Tami Majiki. And then Sipiso and a wonderful pizza outlet, and Mwari Pizza, M-W-A-R-I Pizza, Mwari Pizza. You can follow them on Instagram.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Welcome to The Money Show, brought to you by APSA Access, an award-winning, secure, single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. We're going to touch base with Athol Williams in a moment. Whistleblower in the state capture story, went to the Zondo Commission, spilled the beans on Bain and its role, particularly related to SARS, and is unhappy with the way in which the story is evolving. We'll pick up on that in a moment. And then Pablo and of course, personal finance still to come in the next hour here on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Athol Williams is chief executive at the Institute of Social and Corporate Ethics. He testified before the Zondo Commission in March, and that was to do with Bain and its role in state capture. Bain is a global consultancy group, and it was suspended from Business Leadership South Africa. But Athol Williams has detected that it has been allowed back into the mainstream. Athol Williams, do we know whether or not some sort of due process has been followed in allowing Business Leadership South Africa, allowing Bain back into the fold?
Well, Bruce, some process was followed. Whether it's due process for what we'd expect is questionable, especially given BLSA's own assessment of the long-term devastating effects that Bain's actions will have on our country. If BLSA had assessed that Bain had caused such major damage, you would think that the process would be quite rigorous and the criteria quite demanding. But my assessment of it, Bruce, based on what BLSA have done and what they have now said, is that they haven't met their own process. They've laid out a process which says the following: if one of our members are involved in any unethical practices, we as BLSA will not pass judgment. We'll wait until there is a fair and factual impartial hearing. Then once we get the result of that hearing, we as BLSA will then act. So I accept that. But now my question is, what hearings have they now got access to? Because they passed judgment on Bain, but as you're saying, Bain is now clean. They are being readmitted to BLSA. The Zondo Commission hearing findings aren't out, right? So it can't be that. The U.S. government, the Department of Justice, is still investigating Bain, and so it can't be that. And when you look at the statements that BLSA made yesterday in terms of the process they followed, they say they went and spoke to a number of multinational companies and Bain itself. So, Bruce, that's the due process. Not waiting for findings from detailed, rigorous fact-finding commissions, it's let them ask Bain if they've done all the right things. And BLSA seems to have satisfied themselves based on speaking to Bain itself, not to SARS, the victim, not to investigators, not to civil society organizations, but to Bain itself, and have satisfied themselves that Bain done the right things.
Now, Bain's got a potential problem here, of course, because the Zondo Commission, Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo today asked for an extension to do his report. I mean, it was far too ambitious to assume that he could have done his report within the specified time. He has to have more time. And we don't know what he's going to say about anybody in this process. Yes. He may say Athol Williams was crazy. Athol Williams was completely wrong. Bain is squeaky clean and a lovely bunch of people, and I'm so glad they've been re-included into Business Leadership South Africa. Or he may
highly
say
unlikely. He may say
absolutely the opposite, of course, as well. So, I mean, do we have any idea of the motivation of Business Leadership South Africa to allow Bain back in the fold? Because it is not clear by any stretch of the imagination of the allegations and very strong allegations that have been made to it against it for its role in really damaging SARS and its ability to function.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's really interesting, Bruce, is that, you know, when they suspended Bain in 2018, they were loud about it, kind of, you know, roadshows, press conferences announcing that they've taken this big moral stand. BOSA says that they root out, crush, and punish corruption, right? Wonderful words. But when they let Bain back in, it's silent, right? This happened in June, and they just silently let Bain back in. Now, the impetus for this, for me, is, you know, perhaps they're saying, look, you know, they satisfied themselves that Bain done the right things. And so what I've done is said, let me go back to BLSA statements and see what criteria they might have used. Now, BLSA mentioned five things in their statements about why they fired Bain, sorry, why they suspended Bain, and why they might have let him back in. They mentioned quickly, they want an independent investigation, they want full disclosure to the authorities, they want cooperation with the authorities, they want proportional amends, and they want people who did the wrong things to be decisively dealt with. Now, Bruce, those seem like great things. I support all of those things. But the problem is, none of those things have been satisfied, right? There was no full disclosure to authorities. Even Judge Nugent said so, right? There was no cooperation with authorities. Nugent said so. The Zondo Commission invited Bain to come and testify, and Bain rejected that offer. Bain had not made amends. Well, how could they make amends, Bruce? BLSA themselves said that Bain caused long-term devastating effects. Now, the question to BLSA is, do they think Bain paying back 200 million rand compensates our country for the long-term devastating effects of the cause? And then lastly, this idea that people were dealt with decisively. And I'm curious, you know, in my testimony to the Zondo Commission, I listed all the Bain people involved. Not a single person at Bain was fired. Not even Vittorio Masone, the head in South Africa. He wasn't fired. It took 3 months to negotiate his exit, not exactly decisively dealt with. So we take all those reasonable facts, and we've got to ask BLSA, you didn't follow the process you said you were going to follow, because you only went and spoke to Bain, and these five criteria, which any reasonable person would expect, haven't been met. So again, on what basis do you readmit them?
Arthur Williams. The question is asked in the public domain. It shall be answered. Well, we shall at least make an effort to get it answered. Producers, Business Leadership South Africa, please could you get them? Let's chat to them, perhaps tomorrow, and just replay that last little bit of Athol Williams, already throwing down the gauntlet to Business Leadership South Africa, saying, what process did you follow? Please, can you explain? Please, just explain. Let's hear that part of the story. Pavlo Fotidis in a moment.
The Money Show.
Small business.
The Small Business Focus brought to you by Productivity South Africa, providing solutions for businesses in distress. Pavlo Fotidis likes businesses long before they get into distress, because where does the true value in a company lie, Pavlo? It's the eternal question, I suppose.
It is. And you know, Bruce, it's changing. I'm convinced of this because of, I suppose, the last year, but more recently this year, the number of businesses that have found themselves under massive pressure and almost evaporating or disappearing, whether it be in what we had in South Africa, the riots down in KZN and in Gauteng, or the fires that have raged and continue to rage right across the west coast of the United States, in some cases floods as well. It really got me thinking. It really got me thinking about what lies ahead. Because if you look at, you know, there are three levers of change that are really shifting and reshaping the world for us, all of us, all of us. If you keep your finger on the pulse of contemporary news, you know that there's rising tension and increasing tension and a seeming impasse emerging between the US and China. And North Korea is testing all these new missiles, and the Taliban has now got its own views on how it wants to manage the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a lot of political uncertainty that lies ahead. We absolutely have climate change uncertainty that lies ahead. And I don't think that you should imagine a world that is going to be apocalyptic and doomsday-ish, but don't lose the opportunity to take a step back and say, but hang on, if my business were to vanish tomorrow, if the earth suddenly opened up and I was traveling to work and Before I arrived there, the business got swallowed, everyone in it got swallowed, and everything that I typically understand to be my business got swallowed. Where then is the value? How do I protect it? And most importantly, what would I need to do differently to make sure that I can start up again tomorrow? Because in that, the true definition of that value lies.
And I think so many people are facing that scenario right now, Pavlo. I mean, you talk about the riots, and that's one part of it. But I mean, the other riot, of course, that has taken the world by a storm has been the COVID riot. And in many, many respects, people have faced these sorts of things. And so, I mean, there are lots of accounting terms that can start to describe what value is. But maybe we should just go through it and say, right, what is tangible value? The earth has opened up. It has swallowed up the business. Everything is gone. Except you and your, you know, and the business concept, the idea, the and the track record that you've built up over a period of time. So, what is tangible value in a world of a swallowed up business?
Well, so let's imagine two very different types of businesses, because, you know, using a jargon and terminology can be a bit frustrating otherwise. And if we imagine two businesses, imagine a manufacturing business. So let's imagine it's a business that makes tables. Okay, everyone knows a table. It makes tables. It makes furniture. It makes physical things in the home. And the other business is more, it's a services business. And Bruce, pick a services business. It could be a marketing agency. It could be a legal firm. It could be an architectural firm. Physiotherapy, anything.
Physiotherapy. That's helpful. I like physiotherapy.
Okay, wonderful. So we've got a bunch of physiotherapists and we've got a manufacturing business. So tangible assets are the things that you can mostly see, touch, feel, and exchange. It's something hard. So for example, in the manufacturing business, it's going to be the lathes. It's going to be the inventory, the finished goods, the finished tables, the raw materials. It's going to be the hammer, the screws, the nails, the glue, the fabrics. It's going to be the plant and equipment. It's going to be the vehicles that you would have used to take your products to and from the market and where you would have collected, for example, your raw materials. It's going to be debtors, although it's not physical. It's contractual. It's there. It's tangible. You can collect the debts that are owed to you by your customers. If you've given them terms, it would be cash in bank. Hopefully you can collect the cash out of the bank. So it's all those physical elements that make the business function and operate. If we go to the advertising agency or the physiotherapy business, well, it's going to be the ointments that you might use, that stuff that they put on that just feels so amazing. Ice cold stuff in order to get
the stuff. It turns out that I've made a terrible choice in terms of tangible value. But you would have a client list. You would have a client list as a physiotherapist. I mean, that's got to be the biggest tangible asset that you've got when it comes to this. I mean, the potions and the lotions and everything else got swallowed up.
Yep. Hopefully you would have a client list. Hopefully you would have client files. So you have, but that would have been swallowed up as well.
You saw them in the cloud.
So you've got your tables.
You had foresight. It was brilliant.
Yep. If you had foresight and you had used a piece of software to consolidate all your client files and have client details and client data, in both cases, you already are a step ahead. But in that physiotherapy business, those tables are expensive. You have receptions. You have art to create an atmosphere. You do have machines that either make things hot or cold in order to loosen muscle and get blood flow going in your joints, et cetera, and so forth. So those are all the tangible things. And Bruce, all of them, the whole lot, imminently replaceable. The earth swallowed up these two businesses. And tomorrow, for so long as you were insured, for so long as you had protected the assets that create activity in your business, and you had done so smartly and you'd done so thoroughly, and you were reviewing your insurance policies on a biannual basis to make sure that everything physical can be replaced should the earth swallow it up. Tomorrow, you can have it all back again. It might take time, but truth of the matter is you can have it all back again. So that deals with our tangible stuff that we can see and we can replace because it can be insured.
That intangibles, however, also have a value. And that is often the stuff that's harder to identify.
Yeah. You know, that starts getting into the proper accounting definitions. They talk about something called goodwill and intellectual property. And intellectual property really is, it's about your trademarks and your patents. We don't have a huge amount of patenting activity in South Africa. But it's the know-how, the secrets, the formulas, the algorithms, the copyright. If you've written a whole lot of stuff, in many cases it can be software. Software sits murkily between the two, between tangible and intangible. But your software that you might have designed and written up in order to guide certain activities, all of those are the intangibles. And they become harder and harder and harder to protect because really it's, you know, what is the value of a patent? Well, the argument is going to be that we're going to try and sell the patent out there. Who would want to buy it that would give us a value? Alternatively, what is the value of your trademarks? So we've seen this in cyberspace. We've seen people who squat on certain websites in the very, very early days when internet solutions first established. I remember there was a huge case between McDonald's and someone who had McDonald's.com or .co.za.
Okay.
Yep. And there was this big debate around, well, you know, who, how did he or she get that, and what's its value worth? And it still happens today. There are less so and less so and less so, but you find people who capture intellectual property and attempt to trade it and sell it. But it's harder. It's harder to give value to that because mostly the value is what its earning potential was. And the fact of the matter is that its earning potential got swallowed up in the earth in both businesses. So tangible, easy to replace. Intangible, enormously valuable if you've protected it and you can get access to it. But really, its life comes through trade rather than being inert. And then you move on to people. And sadly, both lots of people were swallowed up in this earth.
Oh, come on. This is terrible.
So as the business owner, you want to get the business back up and running. Well, can we replace people? Yes, we can replace people. Or can you? If you have an argument in your mind that says, well, I can't replace Jack, John, and Jill. Well, why can't you? No, they've got very, very scarce skills. Okay. Well, then in truth, if you can't replace them, it means they own the business, not you. Because without them there, you have no business. Well, I can't replace Sipo, Mary, and Jake. Well, why can't you replace them? Well, they've got the relationships with customers. Okay. Well, then they own the business, not you. Well, and then I can't replace Bradley and Mariki. Well, why can't you replace them? Because they just know how things work and they know how to hold it all together.
But you had no systems, Pavlo. I mean, how long have I told you you need systems, for goodness sake?
I have worked so hard to get you to say that word this evening. I've been moving down that path and I'm so proud of you. Because the fact of the matter is if you had those boring things, the systems, the activities that you've organized into sequences with measured outcomes, that have job descriptions, that have training material, that make sure marketing brings in customers, sales converts them, operations fulfills your promises, administration manages the experience of a client. You can get your people up and running to start those four engines with all the physical assets that you've now replaced because they were insured and covered. And in truth then, Bruce, that being the case, where is the true value of a business? It lies in your favorite word.
In systems.
systems.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And your systems of everything. And so the move to cloud computing is so long overdue. I mean, anybody who's lost a fancy smartphone who didn't have all of their data backed up to the cloud knows you have to start from scratch. And if you've dropped your phone in the loo, or you've, you know, dropped it and driven over it, or, you know, your kids have lost it, or whatever the case might be, you and you've got the stuff backed up. It is as simple as claiming on the insurance, getting the new device and going download, I think. I'll get somebody else to do it for me. But, you can restart fairly easily, provided there is a system and a process and a plan and at least one person who knows where to find all the stuff. Pavlo Fatidis, our Small Business Focus on a Thursday.
The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Access, an award-winning secure single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
No, it's not. No, it's a, we sent him away. We sent him, Warren, go and take some time. You need some time. So what we did was we got Kim Portgieter, who is a certified financial planner. She's a life planning director at Chartered Wealth Solutions. She is an author of a recent book, and she is joining us this evening, standing in for Warren, to talk about personal finance. And I promised I'd ask Pavlo this question because I knew what he would say, but I'll pretend that I asked him. And it is, you know, should you sell your retirement investments and cash in and take that money and put it into a business and grow your business and really grow your wealth? Kim Portgieter. And because people say you should invest in yourself. Why would you invest in anything else if you're not prepared to invest in yourself? Argue the point, if you would. After all of that, she's hiding.
Hello, Bruce.
There we are. There we go. It's called the mute button, and it's a new invention. It only came in last week, but it's lovely to have you, Kim. You heard the intro. Argue the point.
So you want me to argue with who? We're just starting. I thought we could at least go into
it. No, start with a bang. Start with a bang. Come on.
So I heard when you were, you know, earlier as well, I was listening and I understood that I was going to have to go against what you were saying. And you know, my opinion, I have two sides to it. And I think it depends who you are. And I think that is the important part. I don't think, and when I do the planning for people, I like to take them into account. But if you think that you haven't had your own business all your life, and now when you get your retirement money, you're going to open up your own business, then I do worry. And even though you are your greatest asset, and you know that's what I talk about, I do believe that you need the business skills to take it. Because when you're at a certain age, and then you then go and invest all your money into a business, and if it doesn't work out, you're the one then that has nothing left.
And I think it's a fairly common aberration, and I'm going to call it an aberration because I do concur with you completely, actually, that people who haven't invested enough for their retirement go, okay, one, I've been pushed out of the workplace at 60. I'm going to live a lot longer than my grandparents did. I'm likely to anyway. And this money's not going to last. So I tell you what, I've always had the dream of running the coffee shop or running the takeaway or doing whatever it is. I'm going to go and buy myself a franchise because they've got systems and they've got things and they'll help me. And actually, it's easy. And I can still play golf 3 times a week because I put a manager in. Okay, here's my new life. Cash in the retirement savings as much as possible. Pay the necessary taxes and put the money into a growth asset, one that is going to do better than stock markets. And I think a lot of people get themselves into an awful lot of trouble that way.
So Bruce, I really always, when I'm working with somebody, I discourage them to do that. They don't have the experience. They haven't done it before. And they don't have the opportunity to make it back again. So for me, when you were in your early 20s and you did something like that, I totally encourage it. But when you're taking what you've got, this money that you've invested all these years, and you're taking such a big risk with it, I often don't encourage it. If you have surplus assets, and that's money, so I always look at it and I ring fence what your retirement pot is. And then if you happen to have surplus assets and you wanted to put that into that business in red or black, and it, you know, if it went, then that's all right. But I always encourage people rather to ring fence their retirement assets first.
But we hear so many stories, don't we? And this is the, because we don't hear about the failures. Nobody wants to hear about failure. Nobody wants to hear sad stories about disaster and losses of, you know, generations of family wealth. We want to hear about, you know, people going gangbusters and starting great businesses. And maybe we need to be telling more of those stories, Kim, of people who prepare to tell them. And if you've got a tale that you'd like to share with us this evening of somebody in your family, or maybe you did it, and you can tell us what mistake you made. I mean, it's quite a downbeat sort of story to tell, but I think it's an important one that we can learn from. So please give us a shout on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702, because it really is gambling on your 70-year-old self's well-being.
Bruce, I even see it with, let's not even go that you're in retirement. Let's go to many people that I've been working with lately that have got their own businesses. And, you know, I heard on your caller before, they've got their own businesses. They invest absolutely everything. Because the line that I get so often, especially from entrepreneurs, is I'm going to put my money into the business because I can make the best returns. Nobody can make the kind of returns that I can make. So they put every last bit of money into it, their businesses. And then when you have a black swan event like we've had and potentially your business is no longer around, you have absolutely nothing to fall back on. And you've been living out of your business. You've been existing out of your business. So I'm always encouraging people to diversify. So even if you're good and you've got your own business and you're doing brilliantly, I'm still encouraging you to diversify.
And that's, I mean, it's so true. I was just chatting to a friend of mine the other day who very nearly gave up their job in February of 2020. They'd gone away on holiday and they'd really been thinking about the future and they were going, okay, fine. You know what? I'm in a lovely job. I love my job. But actually, my side hustle is what I want to grow and I want to do it. And I'm so good at that. And that is what I love doing. And they were within days and a little... just a niggle. I said, you know, this virus thing we're hearing about, let's just wait and see what happens because this one seems more serious than SARS and Ebola and all the others before it. And they were just saying to me how blooming grateful they were because their side hustle depended on people gathering and meeting and having fun together. And they would have been on the bare bones of their backside by now because they would not have got their old job back. And certainly very few people have been hiring over the last 18 months.
Exactly. And I mean, we don't want to live in fear. So again, I never encourage people to be doing work that they absolutely hate doing for this one day when they're going to do something that they enjoy doing. But what I do encourage is a parallel life. So when you want to start doing that other something, to be starting to do kind of on the side and doing it slowly so that it can take off without you going in and taking so much risk that then you've got nothing to fall back on. So even if you're an entrepreneur and you're really doing well, if you have other investments and something goes wrong, you can go back to those investments you've got potentially to help you get out of the situation you're in and live off that. Although what I have seen, you know, Bruce, during COVID is many people have had their own businesses that have now gone into their investments. They've absolutely used all the investments up. They haven't changed their expenses. They haven't changed the way they've been living. And now that it's been extended, they're coming out of it and they're saying to me, but now we've got no retirement assets left. We've got our business only and it hasn't even picked up the way we hoped it would have picked up.
And that's, I mean, and for so many people stuck in that trap, and I think it's a lot of people because, you know, it's been a tough 18 months and people haven't wanted to deny themselves or their families the things that they've been used to. And they've kind of figured we can hustle our way through this thing because, hey, it's going to end. It's going to end. Vaccines are going to come. People are sensible. We'll make smart choices. They'll get vaccines. It's going to happen within 2 years. and we keep kicking the ball down the road. And finally, people are truly going to start losing their homes. I mean, and many, many are, I'm sure.
And with that, I mean, another thing that I've seen is some people that I've worked with who had a whole lot of their businesses and then they had a properties. And their properties were going to be their retirement investments. And with the business not doing as well as it's been doing, they then decided that they needed to turn to their properties and sell their properties to fund their lifestyle. And they haven't been able to get the value out of their properties. So they've been having to sell their properties at quite a discounted rate. And then they turn to me and they say to me, you know, with doing that, that's now affected their whole retirement plan. And it becomes such a, like a kind of a line in the sand. When do you take your money out of your investments or out of your properties to put into your business? And at which point do you stop and say, well, I maybe need to call it quits with my business? Or like, how long do you just keep on going?
And nobody wants to do that because you kind of feel, you know, it's that real sense of FOMO. People are sort of stuck betwixt in between, and it's a really tough environment. So let's, okay, we know, we told you what you must not do. So Kim's going to tell us in the next couple of minutes what you should be doing. We're 18 months into a pandemic, 19, 20 months. We're into a pandemic. We don't know how long it lasts. Well, we don't know how many metamorphoses this flipping virus goes through. We don't know about the fourth wave or the fifth wave. We don't know whether somebody's, you know, the world's going to have an epiphany and get properly vaccinated. And, you know, there are lots of uncertainties. So how do you best position yourself, not only to survive whatever's left of this crisis until economies get underway? First Round Chief Executive Alan Pullinger telling us things are actually going a lot better than it feels, which I find encouraging. But, you know, you can't live on hope, as Kim was telling us just a moment ago. So personal financial advisor Kim Portgieter, she's an author on personal finance. She is a certified financial planner. More with her in a moment.
The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Access, an award-winning secure single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal finance.
Many years now, we did a 1,000 Rand challenge, and different people on The Money Show came and made their contributions, and Tsekhomudisani lost all the money and then got some money and then gave it back to us. But we and Pavlo made a huge profit and set up Kirsty Bissett, who then set up her own digital agency, which was remarkable. But my favorite side hustle from that series was Warren Ingram's mother-in-law, who has Italian extraction, and she was retired, had some time on her hands. And Warren said to her, take this 1,000 Rand and why don't you use that as input costs for the lovely Italian meals that you make. Make them, freeze them. Next time you come up to Joburg, bring a cold box and we'll distribute that to our network of people. And so she sold her first lot. Then she sold the second lot. And the next thing, I think she was kept occupied for about 4 or 5 years like this. Not on a full-time basis, but a couple of grand a month was doing rather nicely, generating some extra income. And it started a little trend and a little revolution in that household. And that's what you're talking about here, Kim. It's a case of you may not have enough put away. Then learn to live within your means as much as possible and find ways to generate additional income, but not depending on that retirement income. And I think that is the most important lesson that we're going to draw out of tonight.
Very much so. I mean, if you can be earning, just, it doesn't mean that you have to be earning what you were earning before, but if you can be subsidizing yourself through, I mean, I know tonight you've been talking a bit about the side hustles. If you can subsidize yourself through work that you do, whether it's consulting, whether it's like Warren's mother-in-law with cooking. I've got other people who've opened beauty businesses. But if you can be supplementing your income coming from your investments, it just helps your money last that much longer. I mean, I know we talk about this all the time, but you know, for many people, they're going to be living way up to 100. And it's really important that they're having this other form of income coming in. But I mean, also for me, importantly on this topic, is to have a plan so that you know. I find so many people come into just this kind of conversation that we're having, but they've got no idea of what they've got and what they're going to need. So they start making quite emotional decisions right in the beginning, sometimes out of fear. And those emotional decisions, they pay for later. So it's really good to work with somebody, and I know I always promote certified financial planners, but that's somebody who's objective, that can sit with you when you are being emotional and potentially you're going to make a wrong decision, to help you make a better decision.
Frankly, Kim, I don't know how else to do it. There are very few people who can go out and read the books and then apply the knowledge for themselves and remove the emotion, because it is emotional. And I mean, even if you go and you have the sounding board of a financial planner and you want to argue till you're blue in the face, and your financial planner may be a good and patient person who listens to you and then is able to calm your ardor, just to say, I'm going to put everything in crypto, I need to make money, or whatever the case might be. But you really do need that objectivity that cannot exist, particularly if you are under financial pressure. I'm sorry, it's just not, it's we're not built that way as human beings.
Well, we know we make all our worst decisions when we're emotional. So at any time that potentially your business is failing, your marriage is failing, or something is really hard in your life and you try and make these kind of decisions, it's when we really make bad ones. So I always say to people, you know, why not when things are going well? And I really do believe that in your life, when things are going well, that is the time that you do the research to find that support group, those support people that can be there, so that you've got that objective sounding board that you're talking about. And no good going and finding them when you're emotional, because you can't hear, you can't even listen, because you're trying to do things to get yourself out of the trouble. And that's when you do ridiculous things that then put your what you have got at probably more risk.
Tell us some horror stories. Tell us some stories, Kim, of what the sorts of things that people have come to see you. And they should have come to see you last year when they were at risk of making the decision. But, you know, they knew better, or they knew that you'd tell them no. So they went and did their own thing. And they've now come to you and say, Kim, I'm in trouble. Big trouble. Fix it. And, you know, sometimes you can and sometimes I'm sure you can't.
Yes, and I mean, the biggest thing is that I normally have to tell people they need to work longer. So many times what happens, and what's happened to me quite a few times now through this period, is people didn't come in the beginning and they started funding everything on debt. So as things were getting harder, they just took more and more debt, and then they took more and more debt, but they didn't cut their expenses. And it was what you were mentioning earlier. They thought it was going to be over quicker. You know, also our egos are quite big normally, and we say, we'll sort this out, we'll get through this. And we try and be optimistic about it, but we don't change our spending and we don't have that alternative. And then, yes, they do come and see me when they're actually at a stage where they're saying, well, my debt's so high now, now we're in a really bad place. So for me, it is to really have that conversation before it happens. And, you know, you were talking around that starting of a business. And I've seen it way too many times when people really have this idealistic dream of what they're going to do. And you talk about how they're going to have a business and play golf 3 times a week. But generally, those businesses then start taking 5 and 6 days of their time. And as the business starts failing, they start pumping more and more money into it because they're actually getting into this panic stage. And then at the end, what happens is that they lose absolutely everything, including their homes. And unfortunately, Bruce, I do get to see those. So whenever I'm working with entrepreneurs, I'm always encouraging them to have other investments, because if they've got those other investments, they can always fall back on those at the same time. And it's not saying that they're not going to succeed. And I'm an entrepreneur myself. But I always know that I should be diversifying across everything, because that's what's going to help me to stay in business and be successful.
Yeah, but Kim, I mean, if I've got, you know, 2 million and I use 1 million, I'm going to grow half as fast as if I invested the 2 million. I know what I'm doing here, Kim. I know what I'm doing, Kim. Why are you trying to constrain me and restrain me? And I'm sure you have people who just ignore the advice. And some of them may succeed despite themselves. And then they say, I told you so. But I would guess that more often than not, though, people are back to you in a year's time saying, Kim, why didn't you force me? Why didn't you make me do it? Like, you know, kids in music lessons. You know, the 18-year-old kid says to their parent, why didn't you force me to do the music lessons? Well, we tried, but you weren't listening. And it's the same sort of mentality, I suspect.
So I've learned through my many years of planning with people is that you can never tell them what to do. They need to think that it's their idea. And that's where the hard part comes in. because generally, as we're talking about tonight, when you are in that bad state, if you have done something wrong and made a wrong decision, you actually can't even hear properly because you're so emotional. So that's why I think I said it at the beginning. Put all this planning in and do all this work of having, if you've got your own business, a succession plan in place, actually other investments. You know, there's so many different elements that you should have in place. But when things are going all right, so that you're doing it when you're in a much better state to be making these kind of decisions and you find the right people to be helping you to do it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Thank you, Kim. See, no fighting. No fighting. It was very pleasant. Kim Bordgieter, who is a personal financial expert. She is an author on personal finance. She is a certified financial planner, life planning director at Chartered Wealth Solutions, and somebody who tries to stop people from doing enormous amounts of self-harm through making bad financial decisions when things are tough. And we're all guilty of it. We all make terrible decisions when we're feeling strain. And I really would urge you, if you are feeling under pressure, to go and get some help. You're not going to fix it yourself. You haven't succeeded so far. and you know, through all of your courage and tenacity and all of these various things, you haven't managed to do it.